Everyone, welcome to Office Hours with Cloud Posse, your weekly dose of insider DevOps trends, AWS news, and Terraform insights, all sourced from our Sweet Ops community, plus a live Q&A you can't find anywhere else. It's October 2nd, 2024. I'm your host, Eric Ostrom. Real quick, I'm the founder and CEO of Cloud Posse. We're a DevOps accelerator for AWS infrastructure that helps teams deploy their software faster. We do this by leveraging our over 200 Terraform modules that have been battle-tested and downloaded over 100 million times. So no matter where you find yourself on this journey, we're here to help your company launch better products faster. So if you're interested, just head over to cloudposse.com/meet. Again, cloudposse.com/meet. Answer a few quick questions and you'll book a meeting with me directly. So how can you maximize today's session? Well, first off, our format's very informal. You can engage as much as you'd like, ask questions, and if you're curious about any of our open source tools or modules, go for it. This is a great place to ask. And for those of you on the recording, we host these calls live. So join us by going to cloudposse.com/officehours. Again, cloudposse.com/officehours. So I do have one ask. If you find any portion of today's session valuable, go to YouTube and find it and share it with your team so you can spread the knowledge and grow our community and what we're trying to do here at Cloud Posse. So here is what I have in terms of announcements for today. Oops. All right. Well, the first one was a small announcement. It's much needed on GitHub. For the longest time, the only way really to manage runners and GitHub Actions on AWS was being an org owner. And it kind of sucks putting org owner credentials into secrets so you can run Terraform. I'm hoping that with this new CI/CD admin role, that the scope of what you can do with that will make it easier to automate or give the ability to manage GitHub Actions to team members. Yeah, being able to control runners and runner groups is a good one. All right, next announcement is just something that came up randomly through one of my Slack conversations this week in SweetOps. If you are trying to ensure that your clusters are stable and you rely on third-party charts, well, we've discussed many times different solutions of doing this. There's no one way. One way is like an ECR pull-through cache. Another one is using something like Artifactory. Another one is, building and pushing the images yourself in your own registry, and the list goes on. This was an interesting solution. It's a more automated solution. You deploy this controller in the cluster, and it will automatically mirror on your behalf third-party images into your own ECR repository. And once that's been moved over to your ECR, rewrite the image source where it pulls from. I'm a little bit weary of having a lot of operators in the cluster, especially these one-offs. They are frequently unmaintained. It looks like this one's been around for a while, is continuously getting updates based on the checks. So I haven't tried it out, but it came by word-of-mouth recommendation. So sounded interesting. Has anybody used this or similar tool? K8's image swapper?
I've been looking for a solution like this, so I'll definitely check that out. I'm curious to see if it works well with Argo CD or if I have to tell Argo CD to ignore something. Because I'm assuming the mutating webhook will do something.
Yeah. Yeah, hopefully you can specify registries. I think I saw something there about, well, here are examples of protecting against. Hopefully you can filter which registries you're doing it. Like you wouldn't want it to re-mirror like your own ECR repositories or things like that. And presumably you're pulling or Argo CD is deploying services that are have their images on ECR, I'm guessing most of the time. Or
I we've been bit by the Quay outage a few times, in particular with the Argo CD. So this looks cool, but I'll have to try it out and see if it plays nicely with the other 30 tools that I'm using. But yeah. The
Yeah.
other option I've looked at in the past was someone had published an article reverse engineering how the registry actually works. And then you could do some stuff with API Gateway and just kind of like fail over without actually hosting images anywhere.
Really?
And yeah,
Oh,
yeah, I haven't tried that, the
API
current
Gateway
kind
hack.
of,
Interesting.
yeah, it seemed like a gateway hack, and I'm assuming it's abusing some terms of service as well when you're not actually using the Docker Hub host name or the ECR host name. But
Not necessarily sure of that, but API Gateway might not be the cheapest option for serving, terabytes of Docker layers.
well, actually, it's not serving the layers. If I remember correctly, it's
Oh.
redirect magic,
Oh.
and it even supported authentication against the different
Wow.
registries, which, yeah, I'm not,
That'd be really
yeah.
cool. Can you dig that up? I'd like to take a look at it just for,
Yeah,
inspiration.
I'm pretty sure I have it saved somewhere. I'll sock it over as I find it.
Okay. Elvis, I see you have your hand up.
Yeah, would this be similar to maybe better implementation of like a pull-through cache to ECR? Something
Well,
like
yeah.
that.
It's similar. It's not pulling through. It's almost more similar to stale while revalidate combined with a little image swapper. What I mean by that is you will it, you know while it's running initially, it'll just download that image directly from the origin registry. But then in the background, this picks that up. Pushes that same image to your own ECR repository and then rewrites the sources. So pull through it, you directly request from the registry, which realizes it doesn't have that image at that tag and then goes and pulls it upstream. So it's a slightly different architecture. Same kind of purpose, different implementation. Did that answer your question, Elvis?
We're often thinking of having everything go through our ECR rather than directly getting things out in the wild. At least we can have it
Yeah.
scan all the pull through images. Something, yeah, same idea probably.
Yeah, and that's also nice if you want to reduce the amount of requests that you permit your cluster to make outside the cluster, like requests that originate inside EKS and go out to the internet. If you want to lock that down more, having the pull-through cache is one of the ways of one of the many steps of getting there.
Yeah, cool. Thank you.
All right, next topic. Let's see here. Oh, this is a big one. Martin Atkins has or will be leaving HashiCorp and joining Spacelift to work on OpenTofu full time. That's a major vote of confidence for OpenTofu. Martin has been, prolific contributor to Terraform, is always, busy in Hangops answering questions, and as we showed the other day, has a pretty nice development blog talking about some complex topics in Terraform. So I'm really excited about this. That this is just tremendous for OpenTofu. Thoughts on this? Wow, silence from Matt, even?
I mean, you covered it. I don't really have any insight other than I think it's great that more people are going to work on it, especially people who are prominent in the community.
Well, I guess another thing to talk about is what does this mean for HashiCorp? And obviously, large company like this doesn't depend on one person, and product doesn't, this is a product that is the result of, countless engineers and multiple core engineers. But he has been very active in answering a lot of issues or responding to issues in like the Terraform repository. So I think it's not good for HashiCorp to lose a member like this. And I wonder if it's at all related to the IBM acquisition or, things changing behind the scenes there. We saw it last week, we talked about another departure, right? Which was the CFO, obviously totally separate part of the org. Haven't taken a look to see if there's been other notable departures in the past month. All right. Well, that's that announcement then. My final announcement that I caught my eye this week was CubeWall. It was trending on Reddit in particular. Now, there's the Kubernetes dashboard itself, and there's been a lot of these dashboard products that have come out. Maybe one of the differentiators on this one is that it has a really fancy README. Look at this. But otherwise, it's a single binary that you can deploy. And it supports multiple clusters, which is nice. So single pane of glass view, well, not single pane of glass, but one dashboard that you can go and navigate between your clusters and interact with it. I don't know to what extent it's useful. It isn't necessarily something that, I personally want. The other question is authentication. Is this going to require me just to, is the solution to this, oh, just run kubectl proxy and then, expose it that way. I don't like those as much as having a dedicated endpoint that I can get to without dropping into shell and starting a kube proxy. Any other announcements? Let me check the chat here.
Did you
Yeah.
guys talk about System Initiative CA last week? I don't think I was here.
No. What happened?
They went GA. I don't know. I'm just curious, like what the opinion is of their approach. I don't see anything there that's of interest at all, but just curious.
We actually did talk about it only briefly. Was it last week or the week before? Just the notable thing that Matt was saying was that the odd thing with System Initiative is just how little we hear about it, given the pedigree of the founder and how slowly some of the things have been moving. But let's see. Did I misrepresent anything of your words there, Matt? Yeah.
Nope. I'm just always amazed at how we never hear about it, and people have very good you would think very good industry connections and reputation, and it would be further along based on who's involved.
Also been following this StackPack thing a little bit. Anybody taking a look at that? And
What's that? Stack pack?
yeah, they post on the Reddit, the Terraform subreddit periodically. I've been kind of following their development. Again, I don't think there's, I mean, I'm a dinosaur, right? So like it's not appealing at all to me. I'm just, like I'm always curious about products trying to enter the infrastructure as code space. And my opinion is that the only room is in deployment, and HashiCorp has kind of blocked that with the BSL.
Yeah, I can't find my Google Foo is suffering from all my OpenAI usage. What's the URL for StackPack?
Oh, I put it in the chat.
Thanks. I didn't have it open there. There we go. Stack. Okay, got it. I was not spelling it right. Okay, so it's an IDE optimized for is wait, StackPack is wait, I might are they in our Slack community, I think maybe. Yeah. So George Fahmy is in our Sweet Ops community and has presented on this a number of times. I know they're working on it.
Eric, I don't know if you heard what I said before, but the we're only seeing the cube wall thing, not the window that has stack back on it.
It opened up in a perfectly cement, window perfectly outlined by the green highlighted window there. There. Yeah, so this is Stack Pack.
There we go.
Yeah, so I forget if we had them on office hours and did a demo or not. That would have been probably 6 months or so ago. I know that what they're trying to make improve the visual experience of working with IAC. I'm just so against, and I think initially they were working on it as a VS Code plugin, which makes some sense to me. But having a separate physical IDE just to do IAC changes development habits and patterns and all the other plugins that I use and want to use. I think it's a non-starter from my perspective, but maybe it's appealing to a different demographic at a different stage of their usage of IAC.
Yeah, I think what's interesting in there in that space is some people have come to the conclusion recently that in particular that the VS Code plugin infrastructure isn't as powerful as it needs to be to do some things that they want to do. So that's how like the Cursor browser, Cursor IDE has come about because they basically forked VS Code and then created like an AI powered IDE with that. And there's another one I just read about recently that is doing something similar. So I think that maybe this is like they reached the same conclusion that they couldn't do everything they wanted to do as a VS Code plugin. I'm only speculating here, but
No, I think it's a really interesting perspective that you bring up there. And I feel like there's more than just these that I've heard lately.
I'm blanking on the other one. There's another IDE that's for like oh man, Super Maven. So Super Maven actually had their own VS Code plugin. That's how they started. That's how they grew as a replacement for like built-in ChatGPT or built-in Copilot. And their model is super fast and works really well. But they hit a bunch of limitations operating as a VS Code plugin. And now they said that they're going to release their own IDE, which, you know, I don't know. It's hard. It's a hard model to have to keep like, even though they're VS Code forks, it's still, and you can use all the same plugins and everything else. It still is a disturbing factor that now we're going to have like this splintered market of all these like VS Code, you know, forks that are doing specialized things, and it kind of like it ruins the fact that VS Code can do something really well.
And you are using Cursor, right? And pretty happy with it.
Yeah, I've been pretty happy with it. Other than the fact that it's like it's not actually VS Code, but I mean it is like it is under the hood VS Code, but it's you know, it's a different command. It looks slightly different. It does, you know, a few things like all things I guess I could fix. It's just like you know, I wasn't sure how all in I wanted to go on this, but the thing I particularly like about this is you can plug in many different models and choose which models you want to solve your particular coding problem that you're working on, and then chat with the LLM, and the context of everything you're working in your project is like automatically like a first class citizen. You can let it integrate right with that. So yeah, so far I've been pretty happy with it.
That part makes me want to try it out. It's annoying asking questions and it's just totally unaware copilot of the rest of the code base.
I have a philosophical question to ask those of you that are using things like Cursor, etc. So as a newer engineer, one thing that I worry about is if I start using these tools a lot, how will it impact my ability to learn things, right? I think a lot of people who have, you know, more time in their career have the advantage of these things not existing then. So they did the hard work, right, of reading docs, et cetera, et cetera. But like just from a short period of time, I can see that, I don't visit Stack Overflow any longer because I can generally get an answer from Copilot and all of that stuff. If I go full-fledged into an IDE like Cursor, what happens? What happens to me? What happens to my the thing that makes me valuable in the market, that sort of thing? I know it might not really bother senior devs because you already know all this stuff, but for those of us younger in a career, how do you think about it?
Yeah, it's an interesting point because I actually think what allows me to use Cursor or any other LLM like really effectively is knowing what I'm asking it to do, and like knowing the engineering pattern that I want it to follow, or knowing, how I want it to solve a particular problem, or understanding like logic. That it may be confusing, and that's why it's giving me the answer that it's giving me, and it which doesn't seem right. So, like, it is
Yeah.
definitely not a replacement for like development knowledge, but it is a I don't think Cursor or any other LLM writes code that I couldn't otherwise write. It just does it much faster for me.
Like
Like when
autocomplete almost.
Exactly. It's like it's a like a much faster autocomplete. And my prompts are usually like pretty like detailed. Like, write me this thing using, an injection of, a DI pattern, or, or something like that, where I want these three things to be injected, blah, 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 blah. Or I write a function and then say like, write me some unit tests that will help me test these, these five conditions, da 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 da, and it spits them out really quickly, where, that would have taken me, a half hour to write them, and it writes it in like 30 seconds, so that's a huge win for me. But like, start with a blank canvas and be like, hey, craft me an app that does this, and just let it go. Like, I'm less trusting of it, and less like, less thinking it's valuable in those types of scenarios yet. I mean, I'm sure we'll get there someday, but I think the if AI didn't give us hallucinating answers, I would actually tell you it's a great learning tool for you, like when you're earlier in your career. But I also think that it's just as likely to tell you something like that doesn't make any sense, and will give you something that's not the right, not the right thing that you want to build as a, a core foundation of your career, and build on. So,
Those Easter eggs, though, that's what teaches you it actually in the end. Because you have to, that's the learning component of using the LLM is like, wait, this looks almost like it's going to work. How do I figure out?
yeah,
Wow.
that was my thing, is like it's kind of don't trust but verify if you don't know. Like it's so it, like as a younger developer, it might actually be more harmful potentially. In some instances, there are some things that it's really good at, and some things that it's just really not good at. And only by looking at what it produces do I re in my experience do I realize like, oh, it just doesn't know how to solve this problem. And then sometimes I'll be more specific, or take another pass at how I describe my problem, or sometimes I'll just be like, okay, I've already spent too much time, let me just write this myself, because now we're getting into territory where I could do it quicker than trying to ex teach the LLM how to do it, that kind of thing. So I don't know. It's an interesting quandary. I don't think I have a definitive answer for you there, so, but that's my two cents at least.
I don't think the answer has to be mutually exclusive either. I think there's truth to everything Matt said, and agree with it. But I'm also more aligned to agree with Matt on a lot of these things, similar age, similar background, experience, things like that. However, if we look at technology as a whole, I mean, this is just a cyclical thing, happens all the time. I mean, my dad, when he went to college, went to the actual library to look up his reference materials, and that was a requirement. I went to college, I never went to the library once, basically, other than to study or sleep. So I think that, the skill set that we need in life changes. While I can understand that the rigor of going to the library would have been a beneficial thing, not necessarily in my day-to-day life, and it's something I've never had to do as a grown adult. Similarly here, if this is the trend, then you can't put this cat back in the bag. This is where things are going. So I think it's prudent that engineers learn how to leverage these new tools for writing the code. And just like there's a learning curve with the tools that preceded it, there's a learning curve with this. And the new kids, so to say, learning this are not going to have maybe the fundamental understanding that old timers had, but they're going to be a lot faster at asking the right things of the LLM in the right ways and develop their own techniques. Also, we're just
So
very early in on this, right? It's going to be 9 day difference,
I have
maybe.
thoughts about that, but I see Duffy has his hand, so let him go and then I'll say
Okay.
what I was thinking.
Yeah,
Hey, Duffy.
I guess I support Isaac's concern in this. Maybe I don't want to misrepresent what you're saying, Isaac. But I feel like just the nature of something like AI, when it moves into an area of knowledge, it's going to start with easy problems first. And we've all, been in corporate situations where there's a junior dev, there is an intern, someone who's early on their job, for whom you give smaller bits of work and you don't necessarily trust their output. And I feel like that's where AI is going to hit first. And the model for consuming that is, okay, I understand that we're going to put this work on the slow boat. The junior dev is going to take it. I'm going to review it and we'll refine it. But when you do that with AI, you can do that in 5 minutes instead of 2 weeks.
Okay,
So
good point.
you're devaluing the work of the entry level. So it becomes harder to apprentice and get into the skill set that makes you a senior engineer. I think that's the argument. I kind of have some fealty to it.
Yeah,
Yeah, I
yeah.
agree entirely. I think that that is an important aspect of it. But I also think as well, the other side of it is the this idea that there is something to deliberate practice and expertise. And I think, for instance, if I'm a dev, right, let's say, and I get this thing, it's a full stack app, and I get this assignment to remove a div, right? I can, let's say I've never done any React or anything. I can go in Copilot and I can say, hey, I want to remove this div, and it tells me exactly what I do. And I can do it, and I run, NPM run, and it works, and I submit my PR. But have I actually learned anything there, right? Have I, you're able to prompt the AI because you've had those reps in your career before AI came around, and okay, it's going around down the wrong path, etc. So I don't dispute that you'll be really fast as an engineer if you learn how to use these tools. I use them myself in my daily work. But my question is, okay, what if you're trying to do something new, different, novel that is not in the training set, right? Or what happens then when all you know is how to prompt, for instance, and you
Right.
never actually
That's
put in
actually
those deliberate reps of practice and repetition, building things unaided, or maybe at most aided by a Google search of the documentation or something else? What happens to, are we losing something in that by having the AI? And I don't want to sound like a Luddite. I'm all for our AI overloads. It makes my work really fast, but am I losing something in relying on these tools?
yeah, it's an interesting point. And I think like right now where we're at, like really understanding what AI is good at and is not good at is some of the skill. Right now. So like Eric, I don't know if you can open up like ChatGPT really quick. I'll show you like one of the simplest things I use the test to see if it keeps if it's improving at any time. So ask it just this question. How many letters are in this sentence? Question mark.
Thought that worked consistently, but
No. So four, okay, so 4-0 mini is working. Try 4-0 not mini. Like this one will tell you it's 37, and 4-0 will
I
tell
can't do it
you,
without logging
oh,
in.
without
It's
logging
all
in and
money,
everything.
this
Yeah. So 4-0 non-mini tells you it's 26
one.
is the answer. So I just tried it like right now again, just to make sure that it hasn't fixed itself. So like there you go. There's a sophisticated model that they've spent, millions of dollars and countless hours,
Billions.
training and doing all these things, and it can't count the number of letters in a sentence. So, it's a crazy thing.
Something went
Like,
up there, yeah.
yeah. So whatever it is, but like, so 4.0 mini looks like fixed it finally. So actually, I don't know if it did fix it. I don't think that's 30. Is that 37? It looks like too many. I'd have to count it. 7, 8, 9,
That may be
10.
one of those instances, though, where writing the actual code is less keystrokes than asking the question.
Yeah, so that's 32, not 37, if you actually count them. I was trusting it that it fixed itself.
So it's, I get 38 with WC without the echo dash and WC, but I think that's counting spaces and
Yeah,
punctuation.
exactly. So,
That's interesting. Good one.
I mean, and that's like we were just hypothesizing about all these complex blah 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 blah. I just want to make it extremely clear right now, the model isn't good at everything, right? Even and this is the danger, right? Like, put this in a development context where you're a junior developer who doesn't know any better, and you ask it how many letters are in the sentence, and it authoritatively tells you there are 37, and you're like, no, there aren't 37. I can count, So anyway, yeah, it's it's just an interesting, an interesting point to, from my perspective.
So got the R's in strawberry. Good.
Yeah.
So just one last thought on this was just when you brought up the question about like, will this limit innovation maybe in areas outside the domain of the LLM? Like based on what the LLM is trained on, can it actually provide useful answers in new areas? Probably not absolutely net new areas, but one of the interesting things that's come out of LLMs is the ability for it to come up with things we hadn't considered before. And it's done that like in chess play, I believe, and other games where it's you come up with moves that aren't that haven't really been seen before. So I thought that was that's an interesting other take on it, that it can also lead to creative ways of doing things that we maybe haven't done before, putting it all together. All right. Other topics for today or comments on this topic? That's so Roy posted an interesting screenshot here, and I forget about it. I haven't used it with the LLMs yet. OpenAI or ChatGPT released the ability to actually execute some languages, Python being one of them, or is it only Python? So Roy asked the question in the form of a Python response, if you will, and then evaluated the Python, which gave the right answer. So a roundabout way. Cool. Any other topics or questions we can discuss today on office hours?
I have a question around Terraform practices. I came across a repo recently with one of the customers that we're working with where they do a lot of modules instead of a for each on resources or for each in a single module. So they have a lot of individual module declarations. And so we were following their pattern. Long story short, we hit the limits on space left. For memory consumption, because I guess every time you instantiate a module, it pulls down another copy of the provider. And yeah, I was just curious if anyone else had run into this
Oh, definitely.
the
So, were you doing
situation.
a for each over modules,
Oh,
or?
not doing a for each on modules. They were just doing the practice the customer wanted us to follow was a individual module declaration. Rather than a for each. And that's what they're doing in some of their other repos. We're just following their practices. And
Okay.
we we were doing a large enough import for them where we hit these limits on space left. And we took it offline, did some testing, and on EC2, just running the Terraform locally, I hit like 32 gigs of memory usage.
We talked. Yeah, I remember. But I mean, honestly, what it is, it's the monolithic, teralithic pattern, which just doesn't scale. And it's been pro everyone finds this out at some point, and a lot of are, insistent that it's not a problem, but that's why we do it the hard way with Terraform, and it ultimately is the easier way. We have a customer in a similar boat, right? And their plans were taking in excess of 25 gigs as well to run Terraform. I think we talked about this as well. Matt Calhoun brought up the point about, well, one is we shouldn't be changing our design patterns because Terraform can't handle it. We should be figuring out why does Terraform need 25 gigs of RAM to handle this plan. But the reality is that's not going to change anytime soon. So I think it also is really nice to decompose an architecture into what we call components. Components are your root modules, opinionated for a certain purpose, and small root module scale indefinitely. It's just a constant scaling. It works really well, but it introduces a new problem. You don't have it doesn't you don't have a graph automatically between those components, and that requires additional tooling. That's why we have tools like Atmos and Terragrunt and Terramate and other things like that.
Cool. So what I'm hearing is there's no environment variable I could set to to account
Reduce
that.
memory. Yeah, no. I mean, worst case, we've done. We've had to do this. Well, there are a few things. So one is, you can well you run your own space lift runners, right? And then, pay to play and scale vertically. And that's the monolithic pattern is saying, yeah, we like to pay to play. And that's.
That's what the customer's looking at right now, and it doesn't really impact us.
But it's expensive real fast. And self-hosted runners are priced per runner on an annual commitment as part of an enterprise agreement. And yeah, it's just not fun
We
anymore.
get the quote and everything for them. Space Lift's looking pretty happy if this deal closes, but it's
No,
not a
that's why you can just use GitHub Actions and scale with hundreds of runners and not pay anything but the infrastructure cost itself. Anyways, what was I going to say though on that? Go on. What were you
Yeah,
saying?
we were doing a hack at one point trying to see if we could make it work with the debug logs. So you get like the debug outputting in Space Lift, and then it doesn't kill the runner right away. And then we hit the memory limits. All of this is a bad idea. To your point, either change your design patterns of following best practices before each on a model or on a module, or using stuff like Atmos and managing a lot of different stacks or some other tooling.
There's one
But
other thing you can do, but it's not very performant. And I don't know that you can do it on the cloud runners, probably. We've done this in the past where you also provision a swap file. So that way you can use disk. And disks are pretty fast these days, fast enough for Terraform purposes. So then you can add a, 20 gig swap file or something on the ephemeral partition of the host.
I'll have to see if we get away with doing that on Space Lift. I think they'd be surprised if that's exposed, where we could get away
No,
with that.
I, like I said, I don't think you can do it on the Space Lift cloud. We've done it on self-hosted runners.
Yeah, for sure you
No,
can't do it
sorry.
on their public runners. You can, but you can do it if you have your own runners.
They're all in on Space Lift. So like for something self-hosted, we could obviously just buy instances or whatever from AWS or another provider, but when you're using something like Space Lift, you're kind of once you hit the limit, you either have changed.
I just want to make sure that you're clear that you can use your own private runners with Spacelift.
I think that's behind a paywall though, right? Like
Oh
the
it is. Yeah, for sure.
it's Space
But
Lift Enterprise.
yeah, I just want to make sure that you weren't like thinking that you can only it is a paid feature, but that's what we're talking about is basically where you still use Spacelift as the brain that orchestrates everything, but you bring your own compute to actually run the all the plans and applies on. And that's like the only option if you're using it to deploy things like privately in your own VPC that doesn't have, that doesn't have access like outside of your, your firewall and all that kind of thing. So Yeah, but in that case, you can add your own swap, but you definitely cannot do it when you're using their public runners.
Got it. And when you guys refer to swap, you're just talking about standard Linux swap desk, right? Cool.
And it can just be a swap file. It doesn't need to be a partition.
Oh, got it. Cool. I don't think I've done that before. A lot of times I just scale up in the cloud. So it's been a while since I've had to deal with swap partitions. Cool. Appreciate
But
that.
you can avoid having to go to much larger instances by doing it that way if cost is like really a factor. That's the reason to do that versus just use more actual like physical RAM on a box.
Yeah, we did something hacky for them. They were fine with that, breaking out the really big monolith into a bunch of different folders, which I figure, yeah. Long story short, they're going to throw money at the problem, but it seems like it was really interesting to me to see the memory usage just spike up like crazy on my EC2 when I did the test. So I was really surprised that was a thing. And it's to your comment earlier, Eric, it's going to be a while before that thing gets fixed. I think it's pretty low level on how their provider architecture works, but yeah.
No, it is. But this is the liability, and it's so hard to work back. The other thing that you hit, they solve that. Okay. And in the problem solution cycle, you know what the next problem they have? Now they hit the AWS rate limits because they have too many calls to request all the resources across these things, especially if you have a lot of monoliths in the same AWS accounts. Yeah, you just hit the then the and then what do? You can't really check. You can set the rate. You can set the parallelization in Terraform, and now this plan that took 1 hour takes now 4 hours to run instead. And to roll out that fix to fix that thing in production now is a 4 hour change because of the Terraform architecture.
That's actually a good point. I think they've already hit that on some Cloudflare stuff that they're doing. They're using the same pattern across all of their states right now. And yeah, they ran into that with Cloudflare, and they blamed it on Cloudflare rate limiting. I'm like, I don't know. But what you just
Yeah,
said,
exactly.
and
OPP.
yeah, and what you just said makes a lot of sense, because I was unclear if I set the concurrency, if that was impacting each module or not. And in theory,
Will.
would, but
I mean, it should affect it because there's more forks of the provider running in parallel, which use memory. But I'm guessing those. I don't know what the technical term is. Matt might know, but I think they're using the same memory until it changes. But
oh, yeah. I think what I saw, at least looking at all the processes running, it's a bunch of Terraform instantiations, like child processes. And it looked like it was just kicking them all off per module. So I imagine the rate limit would apply. If you set it to one, it would be one across however many, like one per module, which means you can still hit the rate limit, I'd
Oh
suspect.
no, I think, well, okay, that's a good question. I don't know. I assume that was a global rate limit, but I don't know how that would work across processes and if it's that smart. Matt, do you know more on that on the internals there?
I don't know specifically like that thing, but what I was going to say is the way that the provider framework works is that so every time like a module instantiates a provider, Terraform essentially launches the provider as a daemon like in the background, and then it talks to it over RPC. So if you have a whole bunch of like different modules that are like each talking to like a different provider because it's not using like so in a for loop it's considered like the same provider instance, but when you have multiple instances of the module, each one of those is its own separate thing. So it literally like launches another like RPC daemon in the background for each one of those things. And each one of those like RPC daemons takes up like a certain amount of RAM just for overhead of of launching the container and for the communication buffering and overhead to send the messages back and forth. So the more of those modules that you have, the more of those background processes that you have, which also means that it scales up and up and up. I've hated the way that they've done that for a long time. I mean, I guess I understand it because like they need to make sure that if multiple modules are using different versions of like the provider that they can launch each one of them. But I like instead of just like doing a unique, a unique find of all of the versions and of all of the providers that they're using, and standing one of them up at a time, or one like a singleton for each like each unique version, and talking to it. They just do it the lazy way and launch it for everyone that that exists out there. So yeah, I don't know. I don't know what the answer to this is, but it's like it seems like a long it seems like it's going to be a long time before they fix it.
Yeah.
All right. More questions we can get answered today.
Yeah, I was so the other week I was deploying a Aurora global database. Eric, I know you had some qualms about that,
Yeah.
but from those issues that you brought up, we determined that most of them were addressed in this new version of Serverless V2. So we went ahead. I think in Slack I linked you responses to those.
Okay, I might have missed it. I get overwhelmed on Slack. Yeah, the biggest thing was the lack of major version updates. Have they fixed that in Serverless V2?
Yes.
Oh,
Yeah.
okay. That's cool.
Yeah. So and then I think one of the other ones was like global, it was like RDS proxy or whatever it's called. They also fixed that. Mostly there's like one caveat. Anyway, so I was a bit conflicted at how to structure it in Atmos, right? So we have in our platform, let's just say like dev platform, you have like global US West 2 and US East 1, right? You want to have the read replica cluster and the other region and the primary one in the other region. I guess without spreading it across multiple files like I did, is it possible to just have it in the global, but you still need to specify each region and how.
So I forget exactly now. It's been years since we last deployed Aurora Global, but this was not the serverless version. You would have the singular component deployed in multiple stacks in multiple regions, and then there's the part of connecting them to the master cluster, presumably. Then that last part would possibly be a separate component that joins them to the master. So two components in total, and then multiple definitions. That keeps your state isolated by region. That's the other problem being caught with that Terralithic architecture is it's in totally unqualified for multi-archive or multi-region. But yeah, so in this case, you would have the Aurora serverless instance in a stack, say in US West 2 production, another instance in US East 1. And then you have a separate component that connects East 1 to East 2.
And I guess that would be like the global Aurora definition. Because I just took your guys's regional component and kind of hacked on it. And I just used one. And then it's a little bit janky if I have to like update it. And I think actually I learned a lot. I think I need to rewrite this
Well,
component.
that's often how it is, right? The
Yeah.
first pass is just to get it, understand where the bodies are buried or the rock underwater stones
Yeah.
are, and then now you can implement it smoother. But that sounds like an interesting component that we'd like to add to our catalog. So if you want to work with us on getting that designed, yeah,
Yeah, I'd be more than happy to. And I guess right now I have a decision to either do the rewrite now before we deploy our platform V2 fully. But so this one works. I'm not super happy with it, and I'm a little bit dubious of templates being deployed. There's some issues I ran into with enabling basically depending on if it was a primary secondary, I did count equals zero or one and on some stuff and enabling disabling stuff like
Counts are really dangerous on databases. Okay, yeah. Just want to make I would avoid that immediately on any database because you change counts and it destroys it. Like if you change that, well, in your case, you're just using it as a binary. But even if you had like a count of three and you change it to four, it'll still destroy 0, 1, 2, then recreate.
Not like that.
Okay.
I had like two definitions. Like one is the primary, one's the secondary.
Yeah.
And depending on if I passed in the string of primary or secondary, enabled either one. It's like a
Yeah.
switch.
Yeah. Okay. I think
So,
that's safe.
okay. Yeah. Anyway, I think. Yeah. Second pass. I'll more than happy to collaborate with you guys on that.
Yeah, let's do that.
Okay, cool. And then I also had another question regarding your guys's Datadog integration.
Okay.
The docs say, for at least my understanding is that you all the configs